I have been out of town for 2 weeks. 2 weeks ago, I was in a golf tournament. And Gary May and I actually were in a golf tournament together. We came in third place. We lost by 2 strokes. Gary May informed me that I golf far too well to be a pastor, that I need to spend more time studying God's Word and less time hitting a little round golf ball. Last week, Melinda and I got to go to the Hume Lake Romance Conference. It's a special conference that Hume Lake does. It's kind of centered around romance and how God has given us romance in our marriages to really enhance our marriages, to show Christ to the rest of the world, and really to make sure that our marriages are stronger and stronger and stronger, that God is really pouring into our marriages good things and good romance for His kingdom. And that was such an encouraging weekend for us. So I feel like I have been on a bit of a honeymoon, to be honest with you. Golfing and getting away with my wife, these are things that I love to do. And so just as we ended our last sermon that we were going through the Song of Songs together, we ended with the Shulamite girl, who is now the Shulamite bride, and Solomon getting married and the Lord blessing them and saying, "Eat, friends, drink and imbibe deeply, O lovers." A literal comment by God into the relationship of these two and their romance after their wedding day as they head out into their life together onto their honeymoon. God's blessing was all over them. See, God's blessing, number one, letter A, was an important aspect of the dating, the courtship, the engagement, the wedding, and the wedding night. For the romance of Solomon and the Shulamite girl. In fact, the single most important ingredient for any marriage is this. It is the blessing of God in the midst of your relationship. It's the presence of the Lord in the midst of your relationship. Whether you are just starting out and you're dating, or you have been married 150 years, the most important aspect of your relationship is the presence of God. It's His blessing in the middle of that. Without God in the midst of your relationship, you are handicapped. You are stripped naked. You are the blind leading the blind. Two people in a relationship is clearly not enough. A great marriage takes God in the midst of two people to truly make it great. See, up to this point, in what we've been studying, there have been clear stages of the relationship. When we were talking about dating, we understood that was one stage. When dating led into courtship, that was a new stage. And the courtship naturally led into engagement, and the engagement into the wedding day. I call this the male end of the relationship. Guys know what to do at the beginning of relationships. They get how to get a relationship to go from dating to courtship to engagement and into marriage. I mean, it has taken Dwayne Bertram a long time, but he finally got it. And he has made it all the way to the engagement part. See, there are goals. There are stages. It's kind of clear. It kind of lends itself to the male mentality of, I understand where I'm at, I understand where I've been, and I know where I am going. However, once you actually get to the point of your wedding day, and you go on your honeymoon, and you come back home. I'll never forget coming back home with Melinda from our honeymoon, opening the apartment door, hoisting her up over my shoulder, dragging her across the threshold, and then kind of going, well, now what? I guess now we just kind of go on, you know? It's like, what do you do from here? See, things become a little more blurry. Things become a little more difficult. There are not such clear goals. There are not such clear rules. I mean, how often should a married couple spend time together during the week? Well, it varies. Well, how often should a married couple get together and do their finances? Well, it depends. Well, how often should a married couple get together and be intimate? Well, that depends. It kind of varies. Well, are there TV shows we should watch together? Maybe, maybe not. See, there's no hard and fast rules. It's not quite as easy as it used to be. Guys would come up to me and say to me, Chris, whenever she tells you to do something, just say yes, ma'am. You know, that was it. That was all the guidance that you kind of got from your fellow man. What does that mean? They're confused too. They don't know what's going on. See, it might not happen on your wedding day, letter D, or on your wedding night. If you're lucky, it won't even happen on your honeymoon, but it's gonna happen. At some point in every marriage, there is going to be that initial conflict, that first big blowout, and it is going to feel devastating. It is going to lay you low. It is that feeling that you have made some sort of gigantic mistake by marrying this other person. And as you're sitting there on your side of the conversation, you have this sick kind of feeling in the pit of your stomach. I have made a great, gigantic, huge, life-altering mistake. Why am I with this other person? I married a lunatic! And it scares you. It scares you down to the core. Can you tell I remember that day? Well, that also happened to Solomon and his bride. See, what is going on in our relationships, what goes on in our courtships and engagements and marriages and honeymoons and the first few years of marriage, that also happened to Solomon and his bride. And God gives us just a small window into that in the Song of Songs, beginning in chapter 5, verse 2. The Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon, beginning in chapter 5 and starting in verse 2. We pick up the text with the Shulamite girl speaking. She says, I was asleep, but my heart was awake. A voice, my beloved, was knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of the night. See, it was not uncommon, as I note in number 2, letter A, for the couple in this society, in this culture, to have separate bedrooms. That did not represent a lack of intimacy. That had to do with kind of the culture of the time. Solomon had his own place to sleep and to live in the house, and she had her own place to sleep and live in the house, and they would come together, so to speak, for intimacy in either location, but they had kind of their own place to live in these larger homes that existed in Israel. And now that they are a married couple, he comes to her door. Now, the door was probably more like a gate, you know, like we would imagine it, with some iron, you know, black gate, and that it closed, and there was a bolt that closed it. Now, you could reach through and open the bolt yourself. It wasn't like it was a big security issue. But when you closed it and the bolt was shut, that meant that you wanted some privacy. And this is what Solomon encounters. And he comes to her door, and he says, open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. Now, ladies, if your husband comes to you and he says that, what's he looking for? All right, yeah, he's looking for a little alone time with his wife is what he's looking for. He's just come in from working a long, hard day's work, and he comes into his wife hoping for just that little bit of alone time. And you can tell from the way that he is weaving his words. And look at her response. Does she say, open the door, come in, let us lie down together? No, what does she say? I have taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I dirty them again? What? Does that sound like romance to you? No. What does that sound like? Marriage. That's what it sounds like. The Shulamite girl is less than enthused by Solomon's invitation. While we cannot tell why she says what she says, is she hurt? Did he do something that was mean to her? Or is she simply not interested? Is she tired? Does she have a headache? She clearly gives him, though, the cold shoulder. This happens in every relationship. Maybe not exactly like this, but it's going to happen in every relationship where there's a moment of conflict where one person wants one thing and the other person wants a different thing, and the two shall meet kind of stuff. And you've got two people that love one another, but they're going totally different directions. And conflict is born out of moments like these. See, it happens to every married couple at some time or another. Every marriage in all of history has this one common theme. There will be conflict. Not all marriages have love. Not all marriages have passion. Not all marriages have the blessing of children. But every marriage has got conflict. Every last one. Why? Why does God allow that for every single marriage that is out there? In fact, there are conflicts in our society. You would think that the number one reason that couples break up. I've told you before, one out of every two couples in our society, or near two, one out of every two, end up in divorce. Many of you that are here this morning have already experienced this in your own lives, or you've experienced this in your family. You are intimately connected with what it means to walk through a divorce. You would think that the number one reason for getting a divorce is because one person committed some sort of infidelity against the other person. But in reality, that is far down the list. That is not one of the top reasons that people break up. You know what the top reason that people break up is? Communication. He doesn't understand me. She doesn't understand me. Number one reason that couples break up in the United States of America is communication. The second one, sex. The thing that came so naturally when they were courting, the thing that they had to restrain so mightily before, becomes something entirely different in the marriage. And because the needs of the two people are not being met by the other, they completely grow apart, and it can cause destruction in a marriage. These, of course, are also ingredients for infidelity. And finally, the last one, what do you think it is? Finances. Your budget, your money. One of the greatest killers for a marriage is finances. These are the kinds of conflicts that crop up. It may not look exactly like it does in the pages of the Song of Songs, but I would bet that if you've been married for any length of time at all, communication, sex, finances, these types of things have plagued your marriage at one time or another. Why is that important to you? Why do I even bring those things up? Because I think that the way that Solomon responds is given to us as an example for us to follow. We're going to talk about conflict for 2 weeks because this is such a huge part, not only of this book, but also of our church. Let's be honest. There isn't a couple that's in this church that does not have conflict with one another. That doesn't mean it's the theme of your marriage. I mean, it might be for some of us, but that means that every single one of us is dealing with this issue in one way or another. Conflict in the midst of our relationships is normal. I remember when I had just started as the youth pastor here at this church, there was a couple who no longer attend here, conveniently enough. And I was coming down. I usually come down Wardlow. At that time, I lived over in Cyprus, and I was coming down Wardlow. And they happened to be right behind me in their car. And as they were driving in their car, I observed them in my rearview mirror. And I have never seen two people fight so vehemently inside of a vehicle in my whole life. I've seen a lot of people fight in vehicles, you know. You see people arguing, you look over, the girl's staring out the window, and the guy's like, you know, and this kind of thing. I mean, these two are going toe-to-toe in the front of their vehicle, and it's right behind me. And like, they would pull up close to me, and I'm like, they're going to recognize my car, and they'll cool it, right? You know, so I'm like waving to them. They never even looked up. They were just like screaming at each other. I saw their two kids that were in the back seat, literally ducking for cover. And these two are screaming and yelling and throwing arms and looking at each other and just, I mean, the looks on their faces were brutal. And we pull all the way into the church. And I'm like, where do I park? How far away from them can I park? And that kind of thing. So I pull in and they pull up right next to me. And I get out of my car and I'm literally, you know, I need to change my oil. You know, I gotta hide. I'm like looking to hide, and I get out and I grab my Bible and I get my stuff, and they pop out of their car and they're like, "Hey, Chris, how you doing?" "Good. How are you?" "Oh, we're good, thanks. You know, good to be here this morning." And we walk in, and I think they were possessed out on the road just a few minutes ago. There's a demon in that vehicle. We are all doing stuff like that. Maybe it's behind closed doors. Maybe nobody sees it out in the open car. Maybe you lean over to your spouse and you're like, "Oh, praise the Lord, nobody heard what we said to each other. Praise God that nobody experienced what we did. You know, thank God Chris didn't see us in the car," kind of thing. You know, my wife and I have those conversations. "Thank God nobody saw. Thank God nobody could hear." See, we duke it out just like everybody. And I don't say that in a flippant way. I don't say that in a way of just saying our marriage is a mess. It's not. We've got a great, great marriage. However, you put two strong-willed, passionate people under the same roof. And look out, NATO cannot help in those kinds of situations. We are going to work some things out. But it's our attitude about those conflicts that I think matters. And I want us to take a look carefully at Solomon and how he responded to this, because I think he gives us some guidelines, broad guidelines. I know that all of you are going to be able to come up to me afterwards and go, yeah, but what about this? Yeah, but, you know, she sticks the knives up in the dishwasher and I poke my hands on him. I mean, what do you do about that? You know, she doesn't know how to load the dishwasher right. She puts the pots on the bottom and not the top. And I know that there are specific situations in your particular context that are not going to be exactly like I'm talking about. These are broader principles, though, that apply to all of those situations. So don't focus on yourself or your spouse or your relationship, but focus on Jesus. From start to finish, we need to keep our eyes on Him. So take a look. Letter A. Solomon's response to his wife's cold shoulder, I think, reveals a great deal about responding to conflict. Note that this first thing that Solomon does is profound. He does not react. He simply keeps his mouth shut. Verse 4, my beloved extended his hand. Whenever it says beloved, it's the Shulamite girl talking about Solomon. She says, I tell him, I don't want to put my dress back on. I'm not getting out of bed. I don't want to get my feet dirty. And what does he do? It says he extended his hand through the opening. Now, what you would expect is that he is going to what? Unlock the door. But he doesn't do that. It just says, I see his hand extending through the opening in the door. And my feelings were aroused for him. The very sight of him begins to excite her. She begins to double back and go, maybe I will put my dress on. Maybe I will get up and dirty my feet. Maybe just the sight of him is enough to move her in a different direction. But I think the profound part is what Solomon does. He keeps his mouth shut. This reminds me of 1 Corinthians 13:5. Love is not provoked. It does not take into account a wrong suffered. One of the hardest things to do is at that flash point, at that moment when you've been offended, at that instant when someone has done something and your needs have not been met, one of the toughest things in the world to do is not react. I tell you, that is so hard for me to just not react. And yet, that's what Solomon does. It says why does he extend his hand through the door? Well, she gets up, but he's gone. He's gone by the time she gets to the door. She immediately realizes, I've offended him. He was here. He wanted to come in. I saw his hand come through the door, and now he's gone. And she arrives at the door, and look at what it says. I arose to open to my beloved, verse 5, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bowl. What has Solomon done? He has taken perfume or cologne and he has poured it. The reason his hand extended through the door was he was pouring this perfume over the lock of the door. This would be, in the modern vernacular, this is like leaving her flowers. Something aromatic. Something that communicates, I don't know what I did, but I am genuinely more interested in a relationship with you than I am in the offense. He leaves his calling card. She comes to the door to open it, and what does she get all over her hands? His aroma. His cologne. The myrrh that is on his body. She now has it on her hands. He has told her, you offended me, but I will not return the favor. I will not return the offense back to you. As though he has left her flowers after she has offended him. Well, this drives her. The Shulamite girl, let her see, pursues Solomon in the city. She's abused by the watchmen in verses 6 and 7. And the women of the city in verses 8 and 9 kind of mock her and call her out and say, you know, who is this Solomon? Who is this person that you are pursuing? Because certainly you would not treat our king that way. Even down into verse 1 of chapter 6, she is mocked sarcastically by the women of the city. Her search is desperate, but it begins to bring clarity to her feelings
for Solomon. She is genuinely attracted to Solomon, and she says so in verses 10 through 16. Now, I want you to notice that when Solomon is attracted to his Shulamite bride, he goes from head to toe, from toe to head. He describes every inch of her body in very, very poetic terms. Well, she is also attracted to him. Sometimes we make it out to be that guys are purely visually driven and that women are purely verbally driven. They just want to have nice things given to them and to have nice words shared with them. I think that this is partially true. I do, because I look at myself in the mirror and I think, that ain't attractive right there. You know? I mean, maybe I was in better shape when I got married 12 years ago. I was listening to a commentator on this, and he said, you know, someday, those of you guys that are married, you're going to get out of the shower at about 40, 45 years old, and your wife's just going to chuckle. You got less hair, you got more hair, you're a mess, you know? And my wife, that doesn't seem to faze her. She's still, I don't get it entirely, but she's still unbelievably attracted to me. I know that. She tells me all the time. It's crazy. She communicates to me what the Shulamite girl communicates about her man in these verses. See, attraction is real in women just as much as verbal cues are real in men. It's not just a, you know, 100% on that side and 100% on this side. It goes both ways, and a relationship needs both things. She responds. She is clarified as she is pursuing him. She remembers the things that she loves about him, and she is attracted to him. I want you to see the process that she is going through, because God is initiating this process in her. He is reminding her. She has offended him. He has treated her kindly. In fact, he has gone back to sleep with his flocks. We're going to see that in just a second. He's gone back out where he was working before, and he's just going to tend to his flocks, and he's going to sleep out there. And as she's pursuing him, she's realizing things about the relationship. She is reminded about the things that attracted her to him in the first place. You ever go through this process? You say something stupid to your spouse. You say something stupid to the one you love. And then there's a little bit of time and distance, and you realize, am I a complete moron? I love that woman. What am I doing? I got a screw loose or something. I need to go back and apologize. And that's what she's doing. She's pursuing. And as she does, her feelings for Solomon get clarified. The Shulamite girl, letter D, responds to the mocking of the women, saying, no. I know where my husband has gone. See, they're intending to imply that maybe he's gone to another woman. Maybe he's gone somewhere that you don't know about. And she goes, no. I know where he's gone. He's gone back to the flocks. And she says one of the most beautiful verses in all the Bible, one that I believe every married couple should be able to say about one another. I am my beloved's. Chapter 6, verse 3. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. Hey, we may have conflict, but she is rock solid that this guy is going to be faithful to her. And he is rock solid that she is going to be faithful to him. There's no sense of the word separation or divorce in this relationship. There's no sense that if we get a little bit of conflict, one or the other is going to bail out. There is a solid character in the midst of this relationship. She says, he's my friend. I love that verse up in verse 16 of chapter 5. His mouth is full of sweetness. She's remembering kissing him. He is wholly desirable. This is my beloved and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. You want to question his loyalty to me? No way. I remember him. I have kissed him. He is beloved to me. He is my friend. I belong to him. He belongs to me. And so she goes to look for him. And this is the moment of truth, I think, in the passage, right? You ever had this? Somebody's coming back and they're going to apologize. They've said something off the hook, and now they're coming to apologize to you. And this is the moment of truth. They are humbling themselves. They are coming to you. And in verse 4, we get Solomon's response to her. She comes around the corner. You know, out of the stables, out where the flocks. And Solomon says, yeah, you stupid bat. What'd you lock the door for? Why don't you just let me in? Golly, you're mean. I don't like you. Your feet are ugly too. You know, that kind of thing is, you say something stupid back. You mirror the other person. You're like, you punched me, I'm going to punch you back. Degenerates into like, you know, the little second grade brawl in the playground. Except that it's all grown up and it's in the context of a marriage. And words are weapons. No, what Solomon does when he sees his wife is really, I think, the moment of truth. How's he going to respond? What's he going to say? She says nothing. There's no record of what she says. She doesn't come around the corner and apologize to him. She doesn't come around the corner and just go, hey, you know, the lock, I'm sorry. I blew it. Nothing. He responds to her the moment he sees her, and he reaches out in love. You are beautiful as Tirzah, a beautiful location, my darling, as lovely as Jerusalem, as awesome as an army with banners. Now, I know some of these words are not... Like, if you said this to your wife, she'd be like, huh? What? You're as beautiful as an army in Iraq. I mean, that is probably just not, you know, carry quite the same beauty, you know, level that... Look at what he says. Turn your eyes away from me, for they have confused me. Just looking at you sends my heart all aflutter, is what he says. And then he goes into a description of her that is like the description that we already got a couple of chapters earlier. He looks at her and he just says, I am overwhelmed by you. I can't even look at you because you are that overwhelming to me. The Shulamite wife responds with awe and wonder at his response. She says in verse 10, who is this that grows like the dawn, as beautiful as the full moon, as pure as the sun, as awesome as an army with banners? And she talks about how he has raised her esteem by responding in such a way. And not only her esteem has been raised, but her esteem of him has been raised. And she wants to give herself to him because of his response to her. And she says, you have raised my esteem in front of all the daughters of Jerusalem. Our relationship is so good that people are observing it because they know we were having some conflict. I was running around all around town looking for you. And now everyone is going to know. Everyone is going to know what a good thing we have going. What can we learn from this response that Solomon has? So I'm going to pause here in the middle of their interaction. We've got a couple more chapters to go and a couple more weeks to go in our series on the Song of Songs, on summer love. But let's just take a pause point here and get some take-home principles that I think are going to be really helpful for our marriages. I know they've been super helpful for mine. I wrote in you know, each week I change one paragraph in the worship guide. A lot of you don't even know that where my picture is. The second paragraph gets changed every week. Would you please read it? Thanks. Anyway, I changed that. And my original draft was talking about the first apartment that Melinda and I lived in. It was a little one-bedroom place, which I'm sure God thought was hilarious. You know, one bedroom and a kitchen, living room, front entryway, all in one. You know, it's just like big room, little room behind it, tiny little bathroom off the side of it. And so, like, when Melinda and I would get in fights, it would just be like, I'm out of here. Shoot! I got nowhere to go! You know, it was that or the balcony kind of thing. But much to my embarrassment, when we had to move out of that place, you know, when you're in an apartment, you put down a little security deposit in case there's any damage. And so the guy was walking through with me, and, you know, the whole place is empty, and he, like, closes the bedroom door, and he's like, oh, what's this? We got a couple holes here in the back of the bedroom door. I said, oh, yeah. I remember slamming that door and then punching that door and then figuring that the hole I just put in it wasn't quite enough, so I kicked that door because I was so mad at my bride. And then I went over to the bathroom door. And he closed that. Hey, look. There's another hole on the back of this door. Yeah. Different fight, different day, different week, different month. I closed that door. I closed it really hard. It wasn't quite enough for me. So, you know, punched a hole right through the back of the door. Why? One is because I was out of control. But two, it's because I was learning these principles that are listed right down here. We just saw in Solomon that I didn't practice and that I have been learning to practice and that I continue to learn how to practice. And I know a lot of us in this room are like that couple that I was driving in front of. We scream and we yell and we say the worst things to one another. And then we walk in the front door of the church and it's all smiles. Everything's fine. The kids are clean and everybody's happy and hee-hee. How you doing? Good. You know? And we're hiding the brokenness that we've experienced. And so, as I said from the very beginning, I know it would be easy to duck these principles and say, oh, you don't know my situation. But could I strongly encourage you to keep your eyes on Jesus? Because I think He's all over these. I think He's the one that gives us these principles for relationships. The first thing is this. Conflict in a relationship is not your enemy. God has given you conflict as a great gift. I know it doesn't seem that way. I know that when conflict pops up in a relationship, all you want it to do is go away. But God has given us conflict so that it can refine us. Because it causes us to be dependent on God and on one another. In order to have a good relationship with my wife, I need God and I need her. My tendency is to isolate myself. My tendency is to back away. My tendency is to say no to her and no to God, and I will be all alone. I am man. Watch me be an idiot. You know, that kind of thing. I will do this on my own. But see, conflict means that I can't do it on my own. It means that I must be in relationship with my God and I must be in relationship with my wife. It is a refining process. It causes total dependence on them. The goal of conflict should never be to win. This is a tough lesson for me. See, I'm a guy. I love to win. I love winning at everything. I play fantasy baseball and fantasy football. I couldn't play either one of those sports if I tried. But I play on my computer. A lot of you don't even know what that is. It doesn't really matter. It's just a game. And I love to win. When I play my kids in Yahtzee, they're 7-3. I love to win. I like winning. And so it's very easy, right, to take that over into your marriage and you're having an argument and you figure, I'm going for the jugular here. I'm going after this. I'm going to win. If I don't get to watch SportsCenter, then something's going to, you know, bad's going to happen. You know, we freak out over the craziest of things. We try to win, but that is not the goal of conflict in Scripture, and it's not the goal of conflict in our marriages. The goal of conflict is reconciliation. It's saying to the other person, I'm on your team. We're on the same team here. We need to work together in this. We need to seek resolution, reconciliation. I love the quote from Billy Graham's wife, Ruth Graham. Said she was at a women's conference and they had one of those open question things and somebody asked her, do you and Billy ever fight? And the underlying notion is they're pretty holy people, aren't they? I mean, let's face it, Billy Graham, right? Nary a scandal in his whole life. I mean, that's pretty good. People may take issue with some of his perspectives, but I mean, the guy has been stellar. And he's been around since Noah. I mean, he's amazing. Really an amazing guy. His wife and he have had a public relationship all these years. And so they ask her, do you ever fight with Bill? And she laughed. She's like, of course. Of course we fight. If we didn't fight, that would mean one of us was more important than the other one. See, submission does not mean silence. We ought to be people that are seeking reconciliation. We ought to be people who communicate to one another, I'm on your team. We're going to do this together. We're going to seek reconciliation. But that doesn't just mean rolling over. That means that we are going to work this thing out. It means what I will talk about in a few minutes, which is learning the language of the other person and speaking in words and in terms and in ways that they will understand. It's seeking reconciliation, not the win, not the kill. This is not hunting, okay? This is marriage, and it's totally different. See, the goal is not always to avoid conflict, which a lot of people do. They avoid conflict, they avoid conflict, they avoid conflict, and eventually they can't avoid conflict anymore, and what do? They blow up like a nuclear bomb. And it does destruction all over their marriage. See, the goal is not always to avoid conflict, but rather learning how to aromatically argue, or argue in a way that smells good. Learning to fight clean. Conflict is normal, but it should not degenerate into fighting dirty. Christian conflict means learning how to fight clean. It's all in what your goals are. See, if the goal is shock and awe, if the goal is to just bombard the other person and knock them into oblivion, well, you're dead already. Your marriage will die, and you will be the winner of nothing. No. And by the way, this isn't just a guy issue. I know I painted it like that a little bit earlier. No. It's a girl issue too. Women are like special forces in the military. They don't come at you with conventional weaponry. They use like secret things that men don't understand. They're like, believe me, I live with a strong-willed woman and she lives with a strong-willed man, and we just have done battle with each other. And she'll do something, I'll be like, whoa. I don't even know what to do with that. Learning to fight clean means not fighting for the win. It means fighting in a way that says we're together and that we're going to seek reconciliation. We're going to seek resolution in what we're talking about. Trusting God in your conflict, keeping your eyes on Him, means giving up your rights. That just is a broad statement there. I should have put a period after that. Just means giving up your rights. Right? It's putting the needs of the other in front of the needs of yourself. But in a conflict, sometimes there's good reasons for conflict. Somebody's treated you poorly, it doesn't mean rolling over. It does mean engaging the other person. It does mean duking it out at those points. But it means doing it in a clean way and doing it in an appropriate way. So it's giving up your rights to be someone else's personal Messiah. See, you don't get to be your spouse's or the other person in your relationship. You don't get to be their own little personal Jesus. You don't get to tell them what God thinks about what they're doing, which is what a lot of us do. We're like the other person's conscience. We're like their own little portable Holy Spirit. We kind of assume God's asleep at the wheel, obviously, because you are not convicted enough about this issue. And so I am going to engage you as though I am the Holy Spirit, and I am going to tell you what you need to do. I am going to play God in this relationship for you. And you never see Solomon do that. In fact, I would even say you hardly see God do that in the Bible. God truly allows us a radical amount of choice, doesn't He? God truly allows us such broad boundaries in this life. You could actually have lived actively in sin all this week, and by walking through the doors of this church, a lightning bolt didn't stream out of heaven and nuke you right where you sat. Or right where you sit right now. The earth does not open up and swallow you up. Those things have not happened to you, have they? God allows us a great deal of latitude in the midst of this. Why? Because God will be glorified no matter what you do. God will get you. Only the fool says that they can avoid God. My question for you in the context of a marriage is, do you trust God more than you trust yourself? Are you going to jump in and be God, or are you going to back off and let God be God? Tommy Nelson says, when I chasten others, or when I reprimand others, or when I'm someone else's little Jesus, it only hurts them. It only causes them pain. But when God chastens, it can only help the person. See, when you step into the role of God in the relationship, you got no business being there. Get out! But when God steps in and does something, it helps. What would have happened if Solomon would have said to his wife, hey babe, you're supposed to submit to me. Open the door. We're sleeping together.
Would that have gone over real well with her? Would she have had the response that she had? See, she walked through the city, and what does she end up doing when someone says, "Who is it that you're pursuing? What is he like?" God was at work. She said, "Oh yeah, my husband. I remember him. I remember how he looks. I remember how strong he is. I remember how wonderful he is. I remember how good he is. He is my friend. Maybe he's run off to another woman. No. I am my beloved's, and he is mine. I know exactly where he went." And she goes and finds him. And sure enough, there he is. See, Solomon didn't step into the role of God. Solomon stepped out of the way and let God do his work with her. I think it kind of congeals around this idea in letter D. Treat your spouse with kindness during conflicts. This is so hard. That's such an easy sentence to write. Love is not shown by how you treat another person when everything is going well. Loving other people when they're nice to you? What is that? That's easy. Anybody can do that. Love is how you treat another person when they spit in your face. The Word of God says that Jesus Christ was reviled, but He did not revile anyone. Rather, He loved them. He prayed for them. He had compassion on them. He asked God to forgive them. When I'm reviled in my relationship with my wife, when she gets hacked off at me, when I do something stupid and I even deserve it, at that moment, when she treats me kindly, it is so much easier for me to fess up and say, "I'm a jerk. I did something foolish and I am sorry." If she attacks me, if she comes after me, if she doesn't come to me and say, "Hey, there's something I need to talk about," if she just comes in and, you know, guns are blazing and she's shooting at me, no problem, man. I'll jump back. I'll get out my guns. I got big guns, you know. I'll start shooting. And we can just keep escalating everything else. You see the picture on the front of the worship guide this morning? It's that couple arguing. My daughter, who's 7, was stuffing the bulletins this week. She's putting the things in. She said, "Daddy, why are they arguing?" I said, "Well, I'm talking about arguing." "Why don't you use a picture of you and Mommy?" Shut up! Yes. Better seen and not heard. Anyway, when you are in the midst of conflict, do your best to keep your eyes on Jesus and not on the other person. One of the greatest challenges is not to mirror people, but to mirror Jesus. We want to mirror people, right? We're taught from a very young age to defend ourselves. If you get punched in the nose, you know, don't get in trouble, but punch back. We are taught, and those of us that were not physically able to do that kind of thing, we develop great verbal skills, you know, and we could shred somebody up one side and down the other verbally. Everybody's got their ways. There is mirroring people, and there's mirroring Jesus. The Bible says to overcome evil with good. What do I mean by that? I literally mean this. It's learning the language of the other person. One of the things that I share with couples in premarital counseling is that your wife or your husband speaks a language that you do not know. In my case, it's the language of Melinda. Completely foreign language to me. But when I started dating her, I learned a few words. And she liked the fact that I learned those words. She thought that was kind of neat that a guy would do that. And as I saw the excitement in her eyes, I learned a few more words. And we began to communicate. And then we got into our courtship and I learned a whole bunch of more words. And engaged, and we got married. And first years of marriage,
I was learning so much, the learning curve was steep. In fact, I didn't want to learn words anymore. It was so much. There were so many words, it was overwhelming to me. And so, I fell back to my first language. That would be Chris. I know how to speak Chris. Chris is easy. It's my natural language. And so I would talk to her in Chris. And she would look at me all confused. Like, what are you? How could you say? I can't believe. And I would think, what? That made perfect sense to me. Why are you getting so worked up about this? And we would get further and further apart. And the longer I am married to her, the more I learned that unless I can speak in Melinda, I will never be able to communicate with her. Unless she can speak in Chris, she will never be able to communicate with me. Just this last weekend at Hume Lake, when we were up there for the romance weekend, we sat down. We do this once a year in our relationship. We have one weekend where we evaluate. Where have we been? Where are we at? Where are we going? We do it once a year. I cannot encourage you strongly enough to be a part of some weekend where the focus is your marriage. And you have the opportunity to do that. And we literally deconstructed, dismantled our marriage and reconstructed some areas that we felt like we had gotten way out of whack. And it was so funny. We had this inspiring, great, unbelievable conversation right next to the lake. I mean, it was picturesque. God was there. We were together. We hugged each other when it was over. It was awesome. That same day, we got in a huge fight over exactly the thing we talked about right on the shores of Hume Lake. We sat there with each other that night, just looking at each other like two boxers that had just gone at it for 15 rounds. Just like, that was unbelievable. We're two of the dumbest people on earth. We just fought about the very thing we talked about. You know, it's literally three steps forward, two steps back. Three steps forward. The progress is not always easy. But I have got to learn Melinda. And she has got to learn Chris. Otherwise, we're done. We're a statistic. The world will look at our relationship and they will say, you are no different than we are. And may it never be said of a Christian relationship that we look like the world. We must look like Jesus Christ. We must mirror Him. Not only to the world, but to one another in our most intimate of relationships. Will you keep your eyes focused on Jesus? I got one other small thing to say, but I'm going to wait a second. I'd like the worship team to come up. I'd like them to help us focus our hearts on Jesus, because I know some of you could be overwhelmed with taking this home to your spouse, perhaps even a spouse that does not know Jesus Christ, and you feel like just from the get-go, the blessing of God is not on your relationship. It is. You that are Christians are in that relationship, and God says that He is in the midst of your life and He is in the midst of your relationship. He will work good things out. But we must keep our eyes on Him. Not on one another. Not on mirroring people, but on mirroring Jesus. Let's stand and let's keep our eyes on Jesus Christ this morning.